So welcome everyone to our Kol Aharon V'Leia presentation, pre-Purim class, The Run for the Roses. Now I know that this brings up the Kentucky Derby, because the Kentucky Derby is known as the Run for the Roses. This class takes its name from a song written by the wonderful late folk singer Dan Fogelberg. And we'll talk a little bit more about the lyrics of the song later when it will be a little more visible and understandable to us all. But suffice it to say, I'll just give you a little remez, a hint at the outset, that the Jewish people, us, we, are all collectively compared to roses, specifically in the context of Purim. When you finish the book of Esther and Megillas Esther, we all start singing a magnificent poem, Shoshanas Yaakov, the rose of Jacob. Sahala v'samecha was rejoicing. So we are collectively called Shoshanat Yaakov. We are all the roses. So the run for the roses brings in a little more depth, perhaps, to our class tonight. So here's the thematic element of tonight's class. It's a question that you may have dealt with, and we're going to try to answer tonight. We have two seemingly conflicting Jewish ideas. One is called Hashgacha, or more specifically, Hashgacha Pratis, divine providence. We'll talk about that in a moment. Divine providence. And the second is Bechira Chofshis, freedom of choice. And the age-old question, which we're going to try to at least approach tonight, is how do we reconcile the divine providential plan that God, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, our Creator, has for the world from beginning to end? It's hashgacha, it's providential. But that seems to be a stira, a contradiction to the very nature of an individual's ability to freely choose. Because if it's already hardwired into nature itself, meaning God, when he creates our world, puts into nature himself all the codes, all the coding, as Rabbi Yaakov Moshe talked about the singing trees. Everything speaks about a creator, God the creator. And yet, within the confines of nature, what we call Teva, nature itself, you have freedom of choice. But there are things that are limited in this world. Now think about it for a moment. You can't freely choose to go against things that are defined. So I'll give you a funny one, okay? You can't wake up one morning and say, well, my freedom of choice, I decide that I will not recognize gravity. You know, you want to play in the NBA, you want to out-jump Michael Jordan. You say, yeah, I want to have a 7-foot vertical jump. I will not recognize gravity. Well, good luck not recognizing gravity. It's already been defined for you, pal. I'm sorry. You will be subject to gravity, whether you like it or not. So clearly, my freedom of choice is limited. And I'm just using this as a silly example, but just to show you that there are elements of creation that are already defined for us. And therefore, we can't go there. We can't say, well, I, on my own personal level, I'm going to opt out. Yeah? Good luck. Bahatzlacha. So, again, if things are providential, God has already ordained that they will happen, then where do I fit in? Where's my part in the play? And we're going to try to answer that tonight by understanding the pernicious mindset of the villain of all villains, right? I mean, you speak about bad guys. I know you have Darth Vader, and you have Hannibal Lecter, and you have the Joker. That was for you, Lionel. We have some really bad guys in the history, in the lexicon of evildom, right? Bad people. But Amalek, Haman, Hitler, they are in a category of their own when it comes to Rishus, when it comes to evil. So we're going to go from the point of view of Amalek, of the pernicious nation who are the ancestors of Haman, of Haman in the story of Purim, and we're going to try to answer through the prism of our Torah and through the assistance of Rashi's insights, beautiful stuff, and one of my dear Rebbetzin's favorite words, it's going to come up in a Rashi, Ambatya, it's going to come up tonight. It's a good word. So I love just saying the word correctly. It's a great word. It's a good word. So we are going to discuss now Amalek, what Amalek believes as a nation and as individuals. We don't separate. So let's look at Source 1. Source 1 has three verses. These three verses are going to be read from Parshas Ki Tetzé. So this is the end of Deuteronomy of Devarim. And these three verses, if you come to synagogue, you come to shul, and you hear the Torah being read, and we read these three verses, you get one of the 613 mitzvahs. You did a positive mitzvah of Zachor to remember the treachery of Amalek. The Shabbos directly preceding Purim is called Shabbat Zachor, the Shabbos of memory, the Shabbos of remembrance. And we read these three verses. Now remember, sorry, a little play on words. This is not the first report, if you will, of what happened before we got to Mount Sinai. The first, in its original context, story takes place in Parshas Bishalach, right at the end of Bishalach, where it says, Vayavo Amalek, Vayilachem Yimisob Refidim, that Amalek comes, and because we said, is God in our midst or not, Amalek raises his evil head at that point, and there is a suicide bomber-style attack against the Nechashalim Acharecha, those who were cast out from the clouds of protective glory of God, and they attack us. Moses assembles the nation. Joshua goes out and leads the army, and we repel and destroy the Amalek attack. So that's the real-time sort of chronological report. But Deuteronomy, Devarim, which is called Mishneh Torah, it's like a repetition of events that have already happened. It gives us more of an, I hate to use the word editorial slant, but it's God's, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's, processing for us. So you know how in the old days, before they mished this all and messed this all up, my father, Al Vashon, was a huge newspaper guy. So he once explained to me that, you know, certain pages are reserved for just absolute pure news reporting. And if you want to editorialize at all, it's reserved for the editorial pages. And the paper can have its own editorial comments and the letters to the editor and the op-ed piece, you know, opposite opinions, etc. Today they miss it all around. And when they're defaming our beloved Israel, you know, all it takes is a couple words here or there thrown into the so-called news report. And you slant and corrupt and pervert someone's take on the information, which is just supposed to be information, not processed, editorialized information. So Amalek is really good, as you're seeing in our world today, at taking information and just tweaking it and playing with it a little bit, enough where it almost looks like it's true, but it's not. And that's the most pernicious type of lie and manipulation, when it's close to the truth, 98%, but that 2% of kosher, well, I guess it's really not kosher, Oscar Mayer baloney, thrown in there, you know, to try to commit sedition against your mind, to entrap you. Okay, we are now going to understand, from God's point of view, the mind of Haman, the mind of Hitler. It's pretty scary stuff, so prepare yourselves. Source 1, I'm going to read you just in the English, and you can follow along in the Hebrew. This is the three-verse remembrance of Amalek. You shall remember. So this is an actual tzivui, a command. You shall remember, Zachor, just like we say Zachor Yom HaShabbat Lekadsho, you shall remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. This is a Zechira also, to remember. You shall remember what Amalek did to you on the way, when you went out of Egypt, how he happened upon you on the way and cut off all the stragglers at your rear, when you were faint and weary, and he did not fear God. Therefore, it will be, when the Lord your God grants you respite from all your enemies around you in the land, which the Lord your God gives you to you as an inheritance to possess, that you shall obliterate the remembrance of Amalek from beneath the heavens, you shall not forget. So that, in a perfect Torah nutshell is the three-verse, very short, succinct command of Michias Amalek, to eradicate the memory of Amalek. Now, it's a little bit of an oxymoron. I have to confess, it's an oxymoron. Why? Because if you're supposed to wipe out, obliterate the remembrance of Amalek, why are you forcing me every year to come to synagogue to hear about Amalek? Do you hear it? It's an oxymoron of the highest order, right? Because you're saying, well, if you really want me to forget about them, don't force me to come to the shul, to synagogue, to hear about them every year. Otherwise, they'd be a footnote in history. But because we make it a command and you have to hear, then obviously it seems to be contradictory. But it's not, you see. The beauty of it, there's only one perfect answer here. Ready? It must be that by remembering, that is the mechanical way you wipe out Amalek, through your memory. What would that mean? I'll explain. By ascribing holiness, kedusha, significance to the moments, which Amalek doesn't. Everything's random in his world. By ascribing memory, you're actually undermining the raison d'etre, the very lifeblood of what Amalek espouses. The only possible answer. I mean, I'm sure there are others, but that's the most perfect direct answer. So let's look in source two at the magnificent Rashi. Ready? And he's going to explain to us now. This is the editorial board, but it's God's editorial board. So let your heart not be troubled. And he's going to, now we're going to understand what was the mindset of Haman, Hitler, and all the Amalek of history. So he says like this, Korcha, which we're translating literally in the Torah reading as, he happened upon you by chance, is an expression denoting a chance occurrence. Mikra, that's from a sifrit. Yet another explanation, it's an expression, this idea of happenstance, denoting heat and cold, kor, coldness. He, Amalek, cooled you Jewish people off and made you appear tepid after you were boiling hot. For the nations of the world were afraid to fight with you, just as people are afraid to touch something that is boiling hot. But this Amalek came forward and started and showed the way to others. This, and here's the word, this can be compared to an ambacha, to a, I know it doesn't say the word because it's not there. This can be compared to a bathtub of boiling water, into which no sane, I'm adding that word, living creature could descend. Along came an irresponsible, big, schlubby guy, and he jumped headlong into this overheated bathtub. And although he was scalded himself with third-degree burns and was taken away to the ER, I'm just adding a little commentary to Rashi, sorry, he succeeded to make others think that it was cooler than it really was. Wow. So this is the mind of Amalek. Everything that happens is just a roll of the dice. That's why, of course, the holiday is beautifully called Purim, lottery, because it's, there are lots. It's a gamble. Life's a gamble. You win, you lose. Yeah. Sometimes it's good roll of the dice, and sometimes you get 7-11, whatever, and you craps, and you're out of the game. That's just life. That's Amalek. The other is the idea that you were invincible in the eyes of the world. Yeah? In other words, think about it. What was the one superpower of the world? Egypt. By every possible judgment. They were the superpower. So when word spread like wildfire of what happened both in Egypt land and at the sea, the people were terrified. No one's going to mess with the Jewish people. And Amalek, this little Bedouin tribe who had no objective grievance with the Jews, just because we were Jews, though. Who does that sound like? I don't know. You tell me. They come along and they do a little suicide attack because they can't win. The clouds of glory are literally hovering and protecting the Jewish people. In a good way, there was like in Star Wars, we had the Emperor. We love Emperor Palpatine, at least I do, speaking of bad guys. He had the Death Star, had a shield that was impenetrable. So God's shield, the Anane HaKavod, the shield, you know, that clouds of glory, were like that Death Star shield, you know, good luck. It's like they're lasers that melt anything that comes in, right? So projectiles, you know, are just eviscerated. So there's no chance of a successful attack. What was the point of attack? The same point that a suicide bomber has. They're not winning a war against you. They're making an editorial comment that wherever you live, wherever you eat and sleep, you're not safe because I can touch you. That's what terrorism is at its essence. They're terrorists. We're speaking about Amalek. We could be speaking about Hamas. Unbelievable how topical it is. So in the eyes of the nations of the world, we were like that overheated ambacha, that superheated sauna that no sane person would jump in. But as soon as that one idiot went in, and even though he was scalded and barely breathing, he cooled the water down in the eyes of everyone else. The unthinkable was no longer unthinkable. I have to tell you, October 7th, one of the most hurtful things for Israel is that before October 7th, you know, the mystery and the glory and the miracle of 67, the Six-Day War of Yom Kippur, God being with the Jewish people, you know, we having the Iron Dome and all these magnificent technological things, that was all just blown to shreds. So in the minds of every single enemy, would-be enemy of the Jewish people, you don't think what happened with the retro technology of that attack had a tremendous impact on the psyche of the would-be Amalekites, that they're ready to attack Israel also? So Israel's response had to be very calculated, not only to defend its future as an existential threat, but they had to reestablish, if you will, the absolute superiority of what Israel could bring to the table, which I think they've done, Baruch Hashem, but still, it's a work in progress. So you can see that in the mindset is almost like anything else. It's like sports, right? If you believe going into the game, right? I mean, James Buster Douglas is going to walk into the ring with Mike Tyson, who's never gone like two rounds with anybody. Nobody would ever believe that you're in a boxing ring, you're fighting the most fearsome guy ever, right? You give up before you even enter the boxing ring. It's over. So it's all in a mental state. So it was unthinkable for the nations of the world, and then Amalek made it thinkable. Okay, so now we understand that the mindset of Amalek is not only this martyrdom, the idea of I'm going to go into the unthinkable areas against God's people, and ultimately against God, I'm going to challenge. But the very base belief, the thing that drove Amalek and drives Amalek crazy today, is our belief that God is a loving, caring God that cares for not only nations, but relates to individuals and cares and wants to be involved in the minutia of all of our lives. So again, we asked a question at the outset. How do we reconcile this seeming conflict between Hashkacha, what is divinely providential, the big picture stuff, and then the individual choice? They seem to be at loggerheads. So how do we try to reconcile that? We're going to come there in a moment, okay? Look at source 3. And this is just reiterating the nature of Haman, Amalek's belief in happenstance, in chance. Therefore, they call these days that we're celebrating, the 14th and 15th of Adar, coming up now, Purim, after the name Pur, which means lottery. The very essence of the day of Purim has to do with the Pur, the lottery, the happenstance, which is kind of insane, right? Because it's sort of like you name a holiday for the failed weapon of your military adversary. So like in 67, instead of calling it the Six-Day War, we should have called it the Six-Day Kalashnikov War, or the T-52 tank, I think was the Syrian tank of choice. So you're going to name it after the failed adversarial weapon? It's kind of weird. Unless it's speaking specifically to the nature of the Amalek mind. But why would that be? How do we contrast that? What does that mean for us? So let's now get into the story of the run for the roses. And we will reconcile the question at hand. We now have a grasp, I hope, on the nature of what Amalek beliefs. Coincidence versus hashkacha versus destiny. Everything that happens is a roll of the dice and random. You can win, you can lose. Now, can you imagine, by the way, what a nightmarish world that would be to live in? I mean, think of the odds, right? That's all you're doing. You're playing the odds. Every time you drive down the highway, I do this, I see all those blown up big tire truck parts, you know, like the tires, and they have like, I count them, they have 18 or 36 wheels. And you see the tire treads blown up on the sides of the highway, yeah? This is an Amalek thing. My rabbi talked about this. So my wife will attest to this. When I go by an 18-wheeler, six-wheeler, I go by like at 80, 90 miles an hour if I can, because I want to just get past them. I don't want to be caught adjacent to them for too long, because the driver of the truck doesn't even know that he loses a tire. That's why they carry so many. And I always thinking, God forbid that poor soul who is there next to the truck when that tire exploded, there but for the grace of Hashem, go I. So if you want to live a life based on randomness, right, on probability, when that 737 Max is going to lose that door, well, what type of life is that? Can you imagine living a life devoid of warmth, of love? Everything is cold and bereft of meaning and purpose. Everything is just chance. Well, that's the world of Haman. That's the world of Hitler. That's the world that they tried to create for our people. So let us now talk about this amazing moment in the book of Esther. It is the moment. Queen Esther. Here's the scene. Queen Esther needs to go to Ahasuerus, her husband. She, as Esther, the hidden one, has hidden her Jewish identity. She's Hadassah. And I don't know how she did it, but for years now, she's fluttered her beautiful eyelashes at him. And somehow, you know, like I always joke, right? Like at some point, Ahasuerus could say, okay, sweetheart, who are you? Where do you come from? Right? I'm the king. You must answer this question. I do not know how Esther got away with it, but she did. She's amazing. She's Esther. Okay. So she is facing a crisis because Haman knows that when the letter that he authorized, he takes his signet ring. Remember, if your name was Ahasuerus, there's a limit to how many times you want to sign official documents. Ahasuerus. So he probably was the first person to develop the signet ring where you just have it inscribed and you press it into the wax. So the moment he takes that ring off his hand and he hands it to Haman and says, do your worst. And the two of them sat down and drank and had a good old time. That moment brought more Jews back. There was a greater teshuva, repentance movement, the rabbis and Talmud say, from that action of taking off the ring. So Ahasuerus is complicit with Haman. He knows what's going on. Everything is a wink, wink, deniability factor. Okay, so Haman has sent out the letter next 13th of Adar. And by the way, it's months in the future. Everyone thinks that the events are like imminent. It's not imminent at all. The events that happen in the book happen on Passover, believe it or not. And it won't be till next Adar, 11 months in the future, before the evil eradication and genocide against the Jews will happen because of that Igeris, because of the letter. Okay, so Mordechai and Esther cannot be seen together because Haman has spies all over the palace. And he is Mr. Planner. Remember, he's Memuchan, the one who planned every detail down to the nth detail. He knows AIPAC and the Jewish lobby are going to try to get access to the king and to lobby the king to change the king's mind. He's the only one who can save the day for the Jewish people. So Haman has basically made Ahasuerus into a paranoid lunatic, where he has sequestered himself into inner chamber where he does his daily work, and nobody's allowed access to him unless you are specifically invited. And Esther points out via the FedEx messenger service with Daniel that, you know, she can't get access to the king either unless she gets a hazmana, an official invitation. And in lacking official invitation, if she barges in, if he doesn't instantaneously lift up his scepter to show grace towards her, they execute you. It's kill and ask questions later. Even me, she says. So Mordechai, in response to Esther's worry, he says, you're right, Esther. You're absolutely right. I don't know whether you will be successful, but listen to what he says. Number four, it's magnificent. The best, okay, I promise you. For if you, Esther, these are Mordechai's words, remain silent at this time. Imat tacharit tacharishi ke'ish chayazos. Relief, revach, v'hatzalah. Relief and rescue, yamod v'yehudim, will arise for the Jews, mimakom acher, from elsewhere. Relief and rescue will arise for the Jews from elsewhere. Va'at u'besavich tovedu. And you and your father's household will perish. And who knows, Mordechai says to Esther, whether it was just for such a time as this that you attained the royal position as queen. Now, why this is so amazing? Because this is the moment to be or not to be moment. This is defining who Esther is or who will be. So what is Mordechai saying to Esther? So listen to this. Amazing. Esther's worried. She's scared. I don't know whether this is the moment I can save the Jews. So Mordechai says, look, I'm not God. It's looking pretty good that you were taken from me and from your family. And this mad king brought you into his inner circle and made you the queen. It's looking pretty good. The signs are there that this is preordained from God. But I'm not 100% sure, and you can't be 100% sure. We don't know. How could we know? Only Hashem knows. But I do know one thing. If you're going to go, go for yourself. Don't go for me or the Jewish people. Go for you, Esther, because you need this. And if you don't go, and this is the amazing comment, we will get through Haman, I promise you. The Jewish people are not destined to be eradicated by Haman. It's not going to happen. We will be saved. Mimakom acher, something else will come along between now and the 13th of Adar in 11 months, and we'll get out of this. I can't tell you how. I can't define what that salvation will be, but it'll either be through you, dear, or it'll come from Mimakom acher, somewhere else. But know that it comes at a cost for you. Because if you choose not to go, then you and your legacy, and even your great-grandfather, King Saul, whose soul's waiting in abeyance for you to do this, which is another class for another day, you need to do this for you, because that's who you are and that's why you were created, for this moment. But if you choose not to go, it's okay. We'll be okay. We'll get past this. Now, why is this so stunning? Because this is the answer to the question that we asked at the outset. How could it be that I live in a world where things are preordained by God, and yet I have individual choice? Doesn't the preordination crush the individuality? We said, yeah, looks like it, but it doesn't. See, this is where it's beautiful. See, Esther is being told by Mordechai, and we are being told that, you know what? There are moments in everyone's life, and there are moments in Jewish history that are going to happen with or without your participation. But if you are deserving of a moment, then that moment is you and for you only. What happens if I'm not up to the moment? What if I chicken out? What if I'm just not there? I'm not the man I thought I was. Guess what? The moment will happen. With or without you. You will lose the moment. But the Jewish people, the world won't lose the moment. That can't be. So in other words, Mordechai's saying, Haman's not going to win. It'll happen generically. It won't be through you, Esther. Maybe another crazy emperor will come between now and the next 11 months, and he'll conquer the kingdom. He'll kill Achashverosh. You, the queen, of course, you'll die also. He'll kill Haman. The letter will be forgotten about, and we'll go on with a new regime. Finished. The Jews will survive. It'll be a footnote in history. But what won't be written? The book of Esther. We won't be sitting around having a class. There won't be a Purim. There won't be a Megillat Esther. Because Esther, you'll be gone. The moment that was yours will be gone. It's yours and yours, uniquely yours. It's for you, Esther. For you. So every one of us has a moment. Maybe many moments, and they don't, obviously, hopefully, please God, you're never going to face an Esther moment, but they're little tiny moments that are uniquely yours, and maybe you even have a gut instinct where you say, oh my gosh, you know, how come I saw this? How come this was brought to me? How come I was privy to this information? How could, what is God telling me? So hopefully it's a smaller scale. It's not a global universal moment like Esther faced, but the beauty of this is that hardwired into creation was Purim. There would be salvation from Haman. But the mechanical way of how it would be brought about through Esther, Mordechai, etc., that was yet to be decided. Just like with Moses and Mitzrayim. Moses in Egypt, if he argues a little bit too much by that bush, he argued for 7 days, then the casting call would extend beyond Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, to others who would fill the void. And in the absence of Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, there would be an Exodus on 2448, the 50th of Nisan in the middle of the night. That had to happen. Purim or the essence of the salvation of Purim, maybe not the holiday itself, that had to happen. So the freedom of choice means that within the confines of God's magnificent divine orchestration, he specifically leaves room for us as individuals to make differences on local levels and on universal levels. So it's magnificent. So therefore, it's not a contradiction. It's absolutely, one is seemingly, it's just seamlessly woven. We're a potential part of that creation and the providential plan if we see it and we choose it. Okay. The Run for the Roses. So Dan Fogelberg wrote a song, and there's a big debate about whether he's a Jew or not. He sure sounds like a Jew. Fogelberg, you know, he sounds like a Jew, but he may not be true. So it doesn't matter. He's definitely got some inspiration here. And the song on the simplistic level is all about his love of horses, and specifically the Kentucky Derby. Now, just to give you a little horse racing information, probably too much. The Kentucky Derby is run the first Saturday, sorry about that, Shabbos in May. And it is considered the greatest horse race in the history of the world. It is only open specifically to a horse once in a horse's life, a three-year-old horse. If any injury happens, a three-year-old is sick, it doesn't matter what the reasons. He or she runs that day, or they never run again. They have one chance in a lifetime. That's it. And it's actually called the Run for the Roses. So at the end of the race, they award this huge, magnificent, you know, $25,000 bouquet of roses to the horse, and to, I'm sure the horse is very excited about this, right? And the sugar and all the other stuff that the horse gets. By the way, I always find them very cute. At the end of a horse race, you know, they love to interview the athletes. So they always come out with a microphone, you know. I see this after Shabbos, you know. So they go over to the jockey, who's like, I don't know, 5'4", 119 pounds, soaking wet. You know, he is, or it could be a she, there have been female jockeys, English might not be their first language. And they come over and they say, okay, what was it like, you know, when flight plan ran? How did you feel at the turn, you know? And my friend Jeff from Canada used to always say to me, they should interview the horse. He's the athlete. Well, all the jockey did is just go for a ride. You know, you should talk to Secretariat, new Secretariat. How did you feel? Did you think you had a good odds of winning today? You know, they're interviewing the wrong guy. Anyways, just as a side point. So the Run for the Roses is a song about horse racing, but it's also a metaphor. And even Dan Fogelberg, he wrote it as a metaphor for life. He didn't understand, though, that it's a metaphor for our class today and for Purim. Listen to this. Born in the valley and raised in the trees of Western Kentucky on wobbly knees, with mama beside you to help you along, you'll soon be growing up strong. All the long, lazy mornings and pastures of green, the sun on your withers, the wind in your mane, could never prepare you for what lies ahead. The Run for the Roses so red. Listen to this. And it's run for the roses as fast as you can. Your fate is delivered, your moment's at hand. It's the chance of a lifetime in a lifetime of chance. And it's high time you joined in the dance. Wow. So first of all, poets of every stripe see the idea of the dance as a metaphor for life itself, to partake in the dance of life. It's the chance of a lifetime in a lifetime of chance. This is Esther. She's given the chance of a lifetime. So in other words, we're acknowledging that on a Malik level, there is a lifetime of chance. There's a lot of chance that happens. But that's not for the Jewish people. For us, there are moments that are singularly ours to choose. And Esther's given, like the Kentucky Derby horses are given, this magnificent opportunity to become Queen Esther, to become the Esther that will live for eternity. And this is her chance of a lifetime, in a lifetime of chance. So that's Shoshanas Yaakov. As we, the Jewish people, run for the roses, that's our life. We are the roses of Yaakov, of Jacob. And as we make our way in this world, we are running towards the next world. But in the interim, we have these unique little opportunities that God gives us along the way. The chance of a lifetime and a lifetime of chance. And so our duty, our goal, and our mission on Purim is to turn the pernicious mindset of Amalek on its head. We said at the outset, according to Rashi, they happened upon you on the road. Remember that word for happen. Rashi made a very big deal about it in the second source. You can just trust me on this one. He said the word korcha. He happened upon you. Kor. Kuf resh. But kuf resh also has another meaning. We say it every Saturday night when Shabbat ends. We quote it right directly from the Megillah from the book of Esther. Here's number five. The Jews had light and joy and gladness and honor. In Hebrew, La Yehudim Haita Ora, light. We had Simcha, joy, Bisason, and gladness. Vikar, Kuf, Resh. The exact same word that means happenstance. If you tweak the word just very slightly, you can change through love, through your giving over of yourself for someone else, through your care and your warmth. You can take what was cold and bereft of meaning and significance, and in a lightning bolt, we can transform it like we did on Purim time from what was cold and meaningless and chance, the Purim part, that's Haman and Amalek, and we can transform it, as Mordechai and Esther did, into something yakar. And you know what yakar means? Dear, precious. Love, everything that we want for ourselves. So this is our prayer for the Jewish people as we face the Haman and the Amalek of today. Our prayer for the Jewish people, and we need this very badly, is Layuhim for our people living here, and especially Acheinu Beis Yisrael Be'eretz Yisrael, brothers and sisters in Israel. We should have Ora V'Simchas Hasam V'Yikar. We should take the hatred and the venom and the vitriol and the garbage of Hamas and turn it magnificently into something yakar, something precious, dear, and warm for the Jews. I wish everyone a wonderful evening.